You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to an agriculture economist about what's in store for the dairy industry in 2020. First, a WPR podcast called Derailed is helping us explore how high-speed rail almost became a reality here in Wisconsin. It was a central issue in the race for governor in 2010, as Wisconsinites well remember, but it's actually been a hot topic since the 1990s. Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden spent about a year working on the series, focusing on the politics and the personal stories, what this controversy says about Wisconsin. The sixth and final episode is out today. You can check it out at WPR.org/derailed or wherever you get your podcasts. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
And Bridget Bowden is WPR Special Projects Reporter. Bridget, nice to have you here, too.
Happy to be here.
You say at the front of every Derailed episode, wait, start at the beginning. Everything will make way more sense if you go all the way back. We can't do that. That's right. What the podcast is for. Tell us about this brand new episode. What's it about?
This one, how do we sum it up? I mean, this is about what does it all mean?
Yeah.
I mean, generally speaking, I think the train and the details of the train debate that Wisconsin experienced from, 1999 on in through 2009, 2010, those are all things that people remember, but this wasn't the only thing happening during this period. I mean, politics was evolving in Wisconsin. Wisconsin was changing. And so our general premise for the episode six is that the train was kind of along for the ride in this.
That's a really broad thing to take on for a podcast episode.
It is, especially when you consider that all of our other episodes have sort of been based on a timeline. We're telling you the story of what happened and when it happened. This episode is a little bit broader.
We know under President Obama, $8 billion of stimulus money was dedicated to high-speed rail, and then more than $800 million of it was approved for Wisconsin. States were competing for that money, though. Sean, what was Doyle proposing? Remind us.
Yeah, what Doyle was proposing was something initially he started out with talking about, improving the Hiawatha line between Milwaukee and Chicago. That was what he was initially thinking about doing. And then, as it became clear that there was more federal stimulus funding available, and available specifically for high-speed rail, that ask kind of kept growing. So Doyle went to Spain, kind of rode the rails there, saw what was available, and you'll hear a little clip here with some music from the podcast where we go through how the state's ask grew. At this point, that's what the state's asking for, enough to upgrade the Milwaukee to Chicago rail line and start building out toward Madison. But over the next several months, the state's request grows. It starts at around $100 million and grows to $500 million, and finally to more than $800 million.
And in January of 2010, Jim Doyle holds a press conference at the state capitol in Madison to announce that Wisconsin is getting all of it.
This is a 100% funded project. It is just a phenomenal moment. I mean, every single dime that we asked for, we have been granted. So today.
And every single dime is kind of the key words there from Governor Doyle. And it like emphasizes what was different about this award for the high speed rail plan. Just you don't see an award of federal money like this, every day. Usually There's a federal state mix to some kind of a transportation project, and this was a very large chunk of federal money that was designed to cover the entire cost of this project.
Right, and the money was approved, but it never made it to Wisconsin. Why?
That's right. So during the 2000 governor's race, you had Scott Walker running against Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett.
And 2010.
Did I say 2010?
Yep. we've been like deep in this timeline for a while.
Yeah, 2010. And during that campaign, the future governor, Scott Walker, promised to kill this high-speed rail line. It's something that he thought the state didn't need. He thought it would be too expensive. And he thought that it wasn't actually going to be fast enough to be useful for the people of Wisconsin. And before he even took office, the project was paused and the money was sent back to the federal government.
We're talking with Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson, two WPR reporters working on Derailed. It's a podcast that is wrapping up shortly about high-speed rail in Wisconsin. Bridget, that money that would have come to Wisconsin eventually went to California, and you spent some time there. What did you find?
Right. So the money that we sent back to the federal government was sort of redistributed to other states, and the largest chunk of it went to California. And they're building a high-speed rail line between San Francisco and Los Angeles. And it's a project that's still very much in the works and has gone through a lot of changes recently and is a really controversial project and is having some really serious impacts on people who live in the Central Valley of California.
It sounds like then, from what you've seen in California, this idea that high-speed rail would have been super simple and easy if we'd just gone through with it may not necessarily have been the case. The situation's more complicated.
It's important to note, though, that the California project is super different than what we would have seen here because they are creating an entirely new rail corridor. So they haven't acquired all of the land they need yet. So it would have been super different, but you know, the project never happened here, so it's the closest thing we have to sort of look at what could have happened.
And the project never happened here, but we still bought the trains, right? Like physical trains, they exist?
They do, yeah. And they are Badger Red, actually, the colors chosen by former DOT Secretary Frank Busolaki, who is in the Doyle administration. So, yes, I mean, the state spent about $50 million on the trains. Bought them from a Spanish company called Talgo. Talgo sued the state over a breach of contract. Talgo won. So Talgo got paid about $50 million and got to keep the trains. So, yes, they do exist, but they are not running anywhere in Wisconsin.
It's important to note that those trains were that the trains that got built would have run on the Hiawatha line between Chicago and Milwaukee with the potential to build more for the high-speed rail line that never happened. But once the Madison line was canceled, it fell apart from there.
And they exist someplace. We don't have to say where, but you've seen them.
We've seen them. If you listen to the podcast, you can find out where they are.
They're absolutely there. During his run for governor in 2010, Walker called this high-speed rail project a boondoggle. Let's take a listen to another portion of Derailed.
To understand Scott Walker, you have to understand how he got where he is, how he went from a young state representative to Milwaukee County executive and eventually to the governor's office. There were people along the way who helped him, some of them quite a bit, like longtime conservative talk radio host Charlie Sykes.
Well, I actually knew Scott before he was even a state representative. I actually met him before he actually ran. And then got to know him very well when he was in the state legislature, and he was sort of a backbencher. But he was a backbencher who understood how to use the media. And he made himself available and really became a regular on conservative talk radio, including my show.
Sykes hosted a morning.
Bridget, we heard that there about Scott Walker's media prowess. How did that help him pull the plug on this high-speed rail project?
So throughout the campaign, the media, especially conservative talk radio, was really huge in the way that Walker was going against the project. In episode 3, we talk a lot about Charlie Sykes and how Charlie Sykes referred to the train. So you have to listen to hear exactly how that went down. But it was huge.
And, you know, before that, before Walker, before Doyle, was Tommy Thompson. And Sean, you talked with him. He was a big fan of high-speed rail, but later supported Walker's plan to kill it. What happened there?
Yeah, I mean, when Tommy Thompson sort of changed his tune on the train, he was running for U.S. Senate. This was in 2012. And, you know, Scott Walker was governor. And, you know, there's sort of a code among Republicans, fellow governors, that at least among Tommy Thompson, he doesn't openly criticize Scott Walker too often or not too, you know, publicly at least. And so he never has, to our knowledge, criticized Scott Walker on these trains. And he said during his campaign for U.S. Senate that he stood by Walker. That said, if you talk to Tommy Thompson about this proposal, he still proposes, or he still likes it in principle. He thinks trains are a good idea. They're kind of near and dear to his heart. You know, he talks about riding the rails as a kid in Elroy, Wisconsin. They'd hop on freights and ride for like a mile until they left town. And so he still thinks, you know, trains could work. But he also acknowledges that, you know, times have changed and not everybody feels that way.
We have barely scratched the surface. What do you want people to take away from Derailed?
So I hope that people, when they listen to the podcast, will get a sense of how Wisconsin has really changed in the last 20 or so years politically. The story of this train is not just a story about a train. It's a story sort of about Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great kind of vehicle for you to just soak in everything that we've been through, you know, just historically, politically, the recession, the rise of the Tea Party, the way politics are different and were different under Scott Walker than they were under Tommy Thompson. There have been a lot of changes that Wisconsin has gone through as a state. And so this train is just kind of a, you know, I don't mean it as a pun here to say it's a vehicle, but it really does kind of like, you know, you get to ride through this era of history and kind of see just how far the state has come.
Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden talking with us about the Derailed podcast. You can listen to all 6 episodes as well as potentially some teased bonus material. We'll see at WPR.org/derailed or wherever you typically get your podcasts. Coming up next, we'll talk about new data that has some ag economists saying next year may bring good economic news for dairy farmers. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, the first public hearing of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump happened today. We'll find out what America's top 2 diplomats in Ukraine had to say. First, dairy farmers have seen low milk prices for years. And just yesterday, the nation's largest milk processor filed for bankruptcy protection. But a report from the USDA shows some positive signs, with milk production on the rise. That's leading some agriculture economists to say next year may finally bring some good economic news for the dairy industry. Bob Kropp is one of them. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Agriculture and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Bob, thanks for being here with us.
Well, thank you.
You know, we're closing out 2018 in just a short amount of time. How overall did this year shake out for dairy farmers?
Well, a lot better than the year we started. We'll talk about Class 3 milk. That's a base milk price farmers relate to. We were down to $13.84 in February, a terrible price. 2018 were terrible. In October, we were up to about $18.70, and I think we have a chance of maybe hitting $20 here in November and close out maybe at $19 in December. So that's a $5 increase or more, you know. So they need it, you know, because it's been 4.5 years of very low milk price, with 2018 starting out with the worst, yeah.
And do we know what's driving this increase in the price of milk?
Well, part of it is bad news in that with the low prices, we've lost a lot of dairy farmers. We lost about 691 in 2018. And as of November 1st, we've lost 714 this year, more, you know, about 8%. So milk production has slowed to less than a 1% growth. In Wisconsin, we're up about 0.4% in production. Cow numbers are down, production. And the other thing is domestic demand for cheese and butter has stayed fairly good. And exports didn't do as bad as we thought. Actually, cheese exports have held up better than we thought. Actually, have exported more cheese this year than last year. And so those combinations of things has resulted in higher milk prices.
So it is a combination of supply things and demand aspects of it.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Well, one of your colleagues used the word restorative when talking about what might be ahead for farmers this next year. Are they going to be able to dig out of the hole that they've been in these past sure. years with the milk prices since 2014, really?
That's right. Well, I think we'd have to say it's definitely going to be a better year than this year, higher prices average. You know, a lot derives this thing. We don't see milk production coming back real strong because farmers lost a lot of equity. These low prices take a while to recover that. Dairy replacement numbers are lower. The other thing is we had a terrible crop year, spring planting, harvesting good quality forage and that. So forage quality is not as strong, and that usually impacts production per cow. So we don't look
because that's what you're feeding the cows. Yeah, you're trying to get them their proper nutrition.
Right. So they don't look for real strong growth. And we looked at exports could do a little better because world milk production, all the major exporters, European Union, New Zealand, Australia, Argentina, are all having production problems. So we don't see a big growth in world production, which opens up opportunities for us to export.
What about farmers who've taken on debt as they have had low milk prices or have really struggled? Do they need to? Are they going to pay that back before expanding or ramping up with supply?
Yeah, I think that's the case. We're not, you know, somebody's saying, well, we get higher milk prices, farmers respond. That's true. We had low prices in 2009, but by 2010, milk prices were improving, so farmers. But this long period, a lot of lost equity, so, and bankers are being more cautious. The other thing is, if you're going to expand, we still have a fair amount of milk at plant capacity, so milk plants aren't necessarily looking for a whole lot more milk.
And we'll talk about that in just a moment. Bob Kropp is Emeritus Professor in the Department of Agriculture and Applied Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we're talking about whether 2020 might be a restorative year for our dairy industry. We have to acknowledge yesterday, Dean Foods filed for bankruptcy, largest milk producer in the nation. How do different parts of the dairy, like supply chain, how are they affected by the changes in milk prices and the economics of dairy?
Yeah, well, the fluid milk business, beverage that Dean's in, has been a tough business because it's sales declined every year, fluid sales. And Walmart got into building their own milk plant and supplying their own stores, which Dean's had. So how it affects us, Dairy Farmers of America, the largest co-op, it looks like they might be buying the assets there. And the reason is they supply a lot of milk to Dean's. They need the milk plants. So, you know, we got to keep it operating somewhat or else we will lose milk plants for farmers to sell the milk.
Even if that means buying it yourself and doing
it
yourself.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is it possible then? I mean, do you see the Dairy Farmers of America being able to take that on if Dean's wasn't able to keep it afloat independently?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, they have to face that the growth in sales is probably not going to be there. I mean, we're just not drinking more milk. They may have to look at some new innovations, new type of products, and they criticize Dean's maybe not doing enough on it. Fair Life is a new dairy product that came out, a beverage product by a group of dairy farmers and Select Milk, and that's going very well. Farmers looking for something. But, you know, Dairy Farmers America has looked at the fluid side more than, say, Foremost Farmers in Wisconsin that got out of the fluid milk, or Land O'Lakes, greater returns on cheese. So that's a good question, you know. The returns on fluid has not been as strong as in some of the manufactured products.
Are we just seeing a change in consumer demand for milk? Do we just use it differently now?
Well, one big reason is we do not eat cold cereal for breakfast. I mean, that's a major thing. The cereal sales are down over the last decade like 20%. Milk sales down 18%. But that's a factor. The other thing, people are drinking, you know, they go out, eat out more. That doesn't, not at home eating, affects that per capita consumption. It's age structure, et cetera. So it's a number of factors. We're not very optimistic we're going to see a big turnaround in total fluid milk sales anytime soon anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, we're looking at the short term, really, and talking about whether we can see milk prices continue to climb, whether farmers can gain some stability in 2020. What about long term? What are we seeing in trends there when it comes to the dairy industry?
Well, I think in 2020, there's different opinions what price are. I'm looking at the milk prices to average more than $1 a hundredweight higher than they did this year. And, you know, averaging $7.50 to $18 for the class three, where this year it's about $16.80. So that's quite an improvement. But, you know, we don't know what exports. We got trade deals with China that got to be resolved. We don't know exactly what the weather is, et cetera. So we're not going to get over the period where milk prices will go up and down. That is just the nature we're in. It doesn't take much to change change the price with relatively small change, either the production or demand. But hopefully there's some trade deals to work out. We got a new one, tentatively with Japan, could be a big one, South Korea, South Asia. So the export market could be stronger, which would be positive. But to say milk prices will never go down again, we can't say that.
Sure. We're short on time, but let's go ahead and take a call quick. Owen from Wyawega. Owen, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, good afternoon. Yes, I sure appreciate you guys taking the call. Bob, I've got a question for you. I'm a young beginning dairy farmer. I've got some replacement heifers. I've got a couple cows that are milking herd at another farm, and I've been trying to find a milk market so I could do my own labor, milk my own cows, take care of my own calves, me and my partner, Lisa. And currently we work on a larger farm, but what I'm finding is there's no milk market available to beginning American citizen dairymen. I'm watching the farms around me continue to expand, but the labor they use is completely disenfranchised and can't vote. And they're continuing to expand and basically pushing out the beginning farmer.
Right.
Is there any chance of the beginning farmer being able to come into the business?
Thanks, Owen. We appreciate your call. Bob, what do you think?
Well, it's not easy. Some cases, if you can find an existing farmer that will take you in, and if you want to start small and not invest in a lot of machinery, say have your cows, milk the cows, have somebody do your custom work in that, and don't want all new pickup trucks and everything. There's some farmers doing it, and some are going to grazing for, you know, or organic for a little less inputs or a little higher value. So we have some farmers getting into that. And then there's some to find existing farmers looking for somebody to join them and make a deal for them to enter in. And we've seen some of that going on as well.
So there's a lot of community when you're dealing with small to medium-sized farms as opposed to the big ones where maybe we can help one another out here.
Yes. Yes. I mean, small farms, to say we're not going to have no more small farms, a lot of them are hooked up with some specialty cheese plants that have a higher value. They can pay a higher value for farmers for the milk. And so there's ways to do some of that, yes.
All right. Bob, we'll have to leave it there. A lot to watch as we move forward when it comes to the dairy industry. Thanks for coming in today.
Well, thank you.
That was Bob Kropp, Professor Emeritus with UW-Madison's Department of Agriculture and Applied Economics. And we were talking about why some agriculture economists think that the outlook for dairy farmers is a little bit sunnier in 2020. We'll see what happens there. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a Washington reporter about the impeachment inquiry's first public hearing today and President Trump's response. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, state Republicans have declined to take action on a pair of gun control measures supported by Democrats. We hear why from Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. First, we're taking a look at the week in Washington. The big story, of course, is the impeachment inquiry, with the House Intelligence Committee holding its first public hearing as part of the process today. Acting U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine William Taylor and Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent spent the day answering questions from both Democrats and Republicans. President Trump, meanwhile, wrote the hearing off as just another part of what he's called the impeachment sham. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you watched the hearing, what did you make of what was said? Do you think the witnesses indicated a misuse of power by the president? Do you support the White House's pressure for some officials not to testify when called by Congress? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Here to break it down with us is Tolu Olorunipa. He's a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, both George Kent and William Taylor opened their statements focused on the importance of U.S. military aid to Ukraine, the threat that that country faces to Russia. Why was that important for them to communicate?
Well, they want to make sure, and I think the Democrats on the committee also want the public to know that this is not just about a minor policy dispute. This is something that has real implications not only for the lives of Ukrainian officials and Ukrainian service members, but also for American national interests and national security, in part because Russia has been trying to take advantage of Ukraine over the past several years. So they wanted to sort of broaden the lens on the on these hearings and let the public know that this is not just about a minor political dispute between Democrats and Republicans, but this is something that has a real-world impact on not only our allies in Ukraine, but also on the U.S. national security. They were pushing that message as part of the broader discussions that we heard today about President Trump's push to get the Ukrainians to investigate his political rivals. The fact that Ukraine was sort of under the threat of Russian aggression and losing thousands of lives in this hot war that they've had for the past few years with Russia puts into context the fact that the president had withheld some of the aid that the Ukrainians had been using in that war, in part because he wanted to pursue these investigations. So it did put it in a broader context, and it allowed the public to have a better sense of why this is seen as such a monumental situation that has led to a potential impeachment, not only because there is this political dispute, but also because this is the heart of U.S. foreign policy when it comes to Ukraine.
Bill Taylor agreed to come out of retirement to serve as U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And we now understand that once he got on the job, he said he was confused and alarmed at some of the things that were happening well before that July phone call between Presidents Trump and Zelensky. What do we know had him worried?
Well, he put it pretty clearly that there were two tracks of U.S. foreign policy taking place in Ukraine. There was the official track, which involved the State Department, involved high-level diplomats, involved U.S. foreign policy as it's traditionally been conducted. But there was also an irregular channel, another track in which President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, was meeting with the Ukrainian officials, pushing for various investigations that Giuliani and some of Trump's allies thought would be helpful to President Trump's reelection bid, which includes investigations of a Ukrainian gas company that had put Hunter Biden, the son of former Vice President Joe Biden, on its board. The fact that this unorthodox and very irregular channel was taking over much of the foreign policymaking of the United States really confused a lot of people within the State Department, including the ambassador, and it led to a lot of strange instances over the past several months, and a lot of the questions that they had were not being answered, and it seemed that Rudy Giuliani was running a lot of the U.S. foreign policy and not the State Department diplomats who had been, you know, sworn in, who had pledged an oath to the Constitution, in many cases had been confirmed by the Senate. Instead, it was Rudy Giuliani who, as far as we know, doesn't have a security clearance and was acting on the behalf of his client, President Trump, and not necessarily on behalf of the U.S. government, who was calling the shots in Ukraine. And that was part of the reason he was confused, not knowing who was really in charge and whether or not U.S. foreign policy was continuing to be what it always has been, or whether or not it was shifting to a much more politicized and political nature based on Rudy Giuliani's interests.
And we do have Ambassador Taylor referring to that today. Let's hear from him.
I was concerned when the irregular channel appeared to be going against the overall, the irregular channel was going against the overall direction of and purpose of the regular channel.
Do we know how this irregular channel was established or where it came from? Has testimony revealed that yet?
Well, there has been hundreds of pages of testimony from behind closed doors that was already released by the committees that had been investigating this before these open hearings began. And we did get a picture of that from that testimony from several different diplomats who said that back after Ukraine had their elections and elected a new president, there were several U.S. officials who went to that inauguration, and they came back and they tried to get a meeting with President Trump. And during that meeting, President Trump said that all of those officials should talk to Giuliani. The president was not willing to engage with any of the foreign policy related to Ukraine. He wanted to run everything through Giuliani. We've heard from several people in that meeting that the president thought that Ukraine had tried to take him down during the 2016 election and that the place was, the country wasn't entirely corrupt. And for that reason, he had essentially designated Rudy Giuliani to be his point person for Ukraine policy. And in doing that, he essentially blessed this back channel, this irregular channel that Rudy Giuliani was pursuing. And this irregular channel tended to be much more in line with President Trump's political interests and less so with the national interests of the U.S.
Tolu Olurunipa is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. We're talking about public testimony and the background, the events that led up to this in the impeachment inquiry on Capitol Hill. And your calls are welcome. What do you want to know? 800-642-1234. Are there specific people you want to testify in a public arena? Is that important to you, or do you think transcripts are enough? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tolu, what was the Republican line of questioning in witnesses that we saw for hours on Capitol Hill today?
Well, we definitely heard Republicans say that they did not believe this was an impeachable offense. They asked about whether or not the aide that was the center of this this impeachment inquiry, the aide that had been held up by the president, whether it eventually did make it to the Ukrainians, and the answer to that was yes. They asked whether or not the Ukrainians did announce any investigations that President Trump and Rudy Giuliani were seeking, and the answer to that was no. So they tried to say that because there was no essential quid pro quo that was consummated with an announcement of an investigation of President Trump's political rivals, that essentially there's nothing to see here. Democrats obviously pushed back on that, saying that the aide was only released after a whistleblower came forward and said that he was concerned and that several members of Trump's own administration were concerned about what was taking place, and that once they were caught, once there was this whistleblower report, that's when they decided to let the aide go. So that was part of the questioning that went back and forth. Republicans also said they did not believe that President Trump was trying to target only his political rival, but he was trying to target corruption in Ukraine. And it just so happened that the case that he had mentioned, the case that he was interested in, involved former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter.
Did we see Democrats push back at all, challenge this testimony, or get them to try to expand, or were they largely supportive?
Yeah, Democrats did use these witnesses to advance the narrative that they have pushed forward, which is that they believe that President Trump abuses power by trying to co-opt U.S. foreign policy for his own political interests. And they essentially allowed these witnesses to say what their experience had been with that. And they did not feel the need to really pressure the witnesses. They allowed the witnesses to give lengthy opening statements, and those opening statements essentially confirmed much of what the Democrats wanted these witnesses to say publicly, which is the same thing that they've said behind closed doors, which is that they were also concerned about this irregular foreign policy channel in which it did appear that Rudy Giuliani was trying to pursue the political interests of President Trump while also pushing for Ukraine to open investigations as part of U.S. foreign policy. And both George Kent and Bill Taylor were concerned about how this was playing out, and they did think it was inappropriate. There were some Democrats who tried to get the two diplomats to say that it was impeachable or say that it was illegal, and the two witnesses did steer clear. They said they were just there as fact witnesses, and they were just going to provide the information about what they knew. They weren't going to make judgment calls about whether or not any of this was impeachable or essentially illegal. So in that case, some Democrats did try to push the witnesses a little bit further than they were willing to go. But for the most part, they just the Democrats just asked questions and allowed the witnesses to lay out a pretty damaging sense of evidence that President Trump had been involved in wrongdoing.
We're talking with Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. We're catching up on the latest in the ever-evolving impeachment inquiry. And you're part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think today's witnesses appeared credible? Are you concerned about the fact that people who don't like what they said might not take them seriously? Do you want to see other people testify? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Keeley Boltina. The conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about the latest news in the impeachment inquiry. The House held public testimony today for the first time after voting to officially begin the process of investigating the president. And we're taking your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. What concerns you about the impeachment process, or do you think it's important that the public gets to hear witnesses' voices? Let us know. Email ideas at WPR.org. Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olorunipa is helping us make sense of what's happening in these complicated situations. And I want to welcome Nancy from Eagle River to the conversation. Nancy, what are your thoughts?
Yes. First of all, I think that anybody that's been subpoenaed that works in the White House should have to come and testify. I also think that it's time possibly for us to bring in an investigator or a prosecutor like we did with Clinton and was done with Nixon, separate people to come in and talk to everyone and get the information that the world needs to know.
All right. Thanks, Nancy. Tolu, have you heard any traction on something like that, any murmurings, or is Congress really going to take this on their own?
Yes, Congress has mostly taken on the role of investigator, in part because the Justice Department decided not to pursue this, not to investigate, not to have a special counsel or a special prosecutor look into any of this. So that's part of the reason why there have been these behind closed doors sessions over the past several weeks. It's rankled several Republicans who have called for these open sessions that we're now having. But in part because this was the investigative part of this process, Democrats had to play the role of prosecutor and convene what was essentially a grand jury by having several officials from the Trump administration testify under subpoena and behind closed doors as they gathered information and facts. And now we're in the public part of the process, which is more akin to a trial. I don't expect the Justice Department or any special prosecutor in the Trump administration to take up this case. It's likely to be taken in the political sphere through Congress with this impeachment process. And if the impeachment is able to pass through the House, then there will be an official trial in the Senate, which could happen early next year. But that is one key difference between this impeachment process and the one we had after Clinton and during the Nixon administration, where in both of those cases we did have sort of prosecutors who were playing a much more integral role in the process. In this process, it's Congress that's really playing that role, and the Justice Department has decided not to engage in this process.
Let's go ahead and welcome Jim in Milwaukee then to the conversation. Jim, what are your thoughts?
Well, hi, Tolu, and thanks for taking my call. My thoughts are that there's not really a witness. This is just hearsay. These are people that are citing from other people that have heard from other people. And the second thing is I don't think it's a crime or it's impeachable at all if the president wants to look into corruption by a U.S. official, you know, Vice President Biden and his son for corruption in another country. I don't think that's egregious at all.
All right, Jim, thanks so much for that call. And Jim is worried that they're not witnesses, that it's a game of telephone. But Tolu, it sounds like the witnesses in front of Congress are people who have seen and heard things firsthand.
Yes, in some cases, these are witnesses that have heard directly from people who are essentially directly involved in this. There are some witnesses that do have secondhand information. They are reporting conversations that they heard about from other people who were directly involved. The witnesses that do have the most direct firsthand information, including President Trump and some of his top aides, have not participated in this process. The White House has not handed over documents. They have not allowed people like John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney, the White House chief of staff, to testify. So it's a little bit difficult for Republicans to make the case that this is all hearsay. At the same time, they are not calling for people with direct evidence, including John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, and Mick Mulvaney, to testify. And some of the people who have testified do have direct knowledge of these events. And the fact that there is general consistency between the conversations that are being reported across several witnesses does give them more credibility. It's not like you're hearing one thing from one witness and then a completely different account from another witness. So even in the cases where the evidence is not necessarily firsthand, the fact that it's corroborated by other people who have more direct knowledge does give it more credibility. But I do think that it would be much more revealing to hear from the people who have direct knowledge about the president's mindset. And we may hear from some of them next week, including Ambassador Gordon Sondland, who spoke to the president multiple times and had to revise his testimony a couple of weeks ago after he refreshed his memory and said that, yes, there actually was a quid pro quo that he relayed to the Ukrainians, saying that in order to get a meeting with President Trump and U.S. military assistance, they would need to announce several investigations into President Trump's political rivals. And you are hearing more and more from Republicans that they think that that was okay, that they do not think that that was impeachable, and they are no longer saying that this didn't happen. It's more that it happened, but it was legitimate, and it was all about looking into corruption, not looking into interference into the 2020 election. Instead, it was a legitimate interest in corruption in Ukraine that just happened to involve Joe Biden.
Tolu Olorunipa is a White House reporter for The Washington Post, and we're talking about the impeachment inquiry here. Want to bring on now Wes from Kickapoo River Valley. Wes, what's your take on what's happening right now?
Hello, thanks for doing this. I watched the entire hearing. Obviously, the Republicans are trying to come up with a defense. They were kind of basically acting like a defense attorney in a trial. I found one of the things they tried to be really fascinating, which is they argued that there was a quid pro quo, but it wasn't to do with Joe Biden. It wasn't to do with Hunter Biden. Instead, they said that they were withholding the meeting and they were withholding the aid in order to get help with the Russia investigation, to say that it was Ukraine and not Russia. But wouldn't that also be an example of him using his power of office to benefit himself or not?
Yeah, thank you for the call, Wes. Tolu, dealing with the concept of a quid pro quo and when it is for the nation's interest and when it is for political interest, that's a line we're trying to figure out right now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's important to point out that there's no evidence from the U.S. intelligence community that Ukraine was responsible for hacking during the 2016 election. They have attributed that to Russia very directly and very publicly. So it does appear that President Trump and Rudy Giuliani were trying to get Ukraine to investigate what, by all intents and purposes from the U.S. intelligence community, is a conspiracy theory. And that conspiracy theory could potentially benefit President Trump personally, because he feels that he was wrongly accused of colluding with Russia. And if there was some way to make it less clear that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, that could benefit President Trump directly by making him making the entire Russia collusion argument less credible. So there is a sense that even that form of a quid pro quo would be problematic, because it's not in the U.S. national interest to have Ukraine investigating something that is a conspiracy theory for the president's benefit. So that's something that Democrats are pushing as well. But the 2020 argument and the idea that the quid pro quo was directly related to Hunter Biden and Joe Biden is a much clearer argument for the Democrats. And that's why I think they focus more on that part and less on the idea of whether or not there was an investigation related to 2016 and Ukrainian interference in the election.
Tolu, we just have a moment left, but I want to get a picture of the White House's response after day one of this public testimony. What are you seeing?
Oh, well, the White House is saying that this is all secondhand, third-hand information that none of these witnesses actually spoke to the president and did not know his mindset. They are pushing back against these career diplomats, saying that this was just a policy dispute. This was just unelected bureaucrats trying to voice their discomfort with President Trump's style of foreign policy, and that none of what they said was actually impeachable. So that's the response from the White House thus far, and I think we'll expect to hear more of that as we hear from more witnesses in the weeks ahead.
Absolutely. Tolu, thank you for joining us today.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Tolu Olorunipa is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. He talked with us about the first public hearings on the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Coming up later in the show, we'll talk with a guest who says the media can improve the way they're covering the inquiry and public hearings. She'll talk with us about where she sees the press falling short and what they can do differently. That's coming up in about 30 minutes right here on Central Time. If you've noticed a surge in cardigan wearing today, you can thank World Kindness Day. The TV station home to Mr. Rogers declared today World Kindness Day to honor the public broadcasting's personality's legacy and promote some good. I, myself, am sporting a mint green cardigan. And Judith Sears-Poissant is here in studio wearing a lovely striped black and beige number.
I don't think Mr. Rogers did a lot of stripes, but, you know, no. I think you would appreciate me taking it and running with it. I have to say, I love Mr. Rogers. The documentary that came out, Won't You Be My Neighbor? I was a puddle on the ground watching it. And this new movie with Tom Hanks coming out, I think, has really brought Mr. Rogers as a person, not just as a personality, to a lot of people.
Right. And there's something about it that combines the nostalgia of watching it when you were younger and really understanding that experience with Mr. Rogers. And then also just kind of looking around and going, yeah, maybe we could be a little bit kinder to one another.
It's not bad. We shouldn't need reminders or, you know, reasons to do it, but I will take them wherever they come.
And if it means coming in the form of a lovely sweater with buttons down the front.
They're very cozy.
Or a zipper. Yeah, either way.
There's
a
reason.
Perfectly. Sounds good. Well, you can see our photo on Twitter with the hashtag World Kindness Day, and you can share your cardigan style with us. Tweet your photo at Central Time. Judith, thanks for being here.
Of course.
I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.